Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
With so many new podcasts, how do you find your next obsession? Try Pocket Casts, the free podcast app designed by listeners for listeners. With curated recommendations, discovery is easy and seamless. When you find something you like, just hit play. Find all your favorite shows, old and new, at pocketcast.com or find us in the Apple app or Google Play stores.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 26th of March, these are our main stories. The United Nations Secretary General has described coronavirus as a threat to all of humanity. The American Secretary of State has repeated criticism of what he called Chinese disinformation in the early stages of the pandemic. Britain's Prime Minister has been defending the government's response to the health crisis in the face of accusations that medical staff have been forced to buy their own protective gear.
As the Health Secretary has explained many times, we are massively increasing our testing campaign, going up from 5,000 to 25,000 a day.
The UN Secretary General has called the coronavirus pandemic a threat to all of humanity and said all of humanity must fight back. Antonio Guterres stressed that individual country responses were not going to be enough and that cooperation and solidarity were crucial. He was speaking on the day the UN launched a $2 billion funding drive to help vulnerable countries which lack even the most basic healthcare facilities. Here's our World Affairs correspondent, Naomi Grimley.
The UN is worried about how some of the poorest countries in the world will cope with the COVID-19 pandemic, especially if they're already contending with conflict or natural disasters. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is warning richer countries that if they don't help out the weaker ones, coronavirus could circle back around the globe.
We must come to the aid of the ultra vulnerable, millions upon millions of people who are least able to protect themselves. This is a matter of basic human solidarity. And it is also crucial for combating the virus. The world is only as strong as our weakest health system. If we do not act decisively now, I fear the virus will establish a foothold in the most fragile countries, leaving the whole world vulnerable. This is the moment to step up for the vulnerable.
The extra funds raised will provide vulnerable countries with laboratory test equipment, hand-washing facilities in refugee camps, and an air bridge for humanitarian workers to get to the worst affected areas.
Naomi Grimley. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization has been emphasising the need for continued testing, quarantining and tracing the source of infections. Speaking in Geneva, the head of the WHO, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, also said countries which have imposed social restrictions needed to take further steps to make sure their citizens were safe.
The last thing any country needs is to open schools and businesses only to be forced to close them again because of a resurgence. Aggressive measures to find, isolate, test, treat and trace are not only the best and fastest way out of extreme social and economic restrictions, they are also the best way to prevent them.
That was Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus from the World Health Organization. Well, the US Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, says foreign ministers at Wednesday's G7 conference discussed what he called China's intentional disinformation campaign about the origins of the coronavirus. Mr. Pompeo said diplomats were aware of a campaign to create conspiracy theories about the source of the virus, which originated in the Chinese city of Wuhan. From Washington, here's Barbara Petasha.
The Trump administration has repeatedly charged that China was and is suppressing information about the coronavirus. President Trump has taken to calling it the Chinese virus, angering Beijing and ignoring World Health Organization guidelines. Some Chinese officials have suggested that the virus was brought to China by the U.S. military. Mr. Pompeo dismissed that as crazy talking, and he also appeared to dismiss China's sales of medical supplies to combat the pandemic, saying Beijing was now trying to claim that it was the white hat.
Barbara Pletasha. There seems to be growing criticism of how Brazil's president is handling the crisis. Jair Bolsonaro has been downplaying the threat of the pandemic. He criticised school and business lockdowns put in place by regional governors. Brazil has reported 2,200 confirmed infections and 46 deaths. A reporter in Sao Paulo, Camila Mota, told me how Mr. Bolsonaro's comments made in a televised address on Tuesday night had been received.
The speech that the president gave yesterday created an instant backlash. Politicians, Supreme Court judges, and several medical societies here in Brazil issued statements criticizing the president, calling him irresponsible and disrespectful to the medical and scientific community.
And what about the reaction from ordinary people? I hear on social media there's increasing criticism.
And not just social media. For the past 6 days, Brazilians have gone out to their windows at around 8 o'clock-ish to bang pots and pans and express their frustration with their president.
So, but in spite of this opposition, it seems that Mr. Bolsonaro perhaps is getting his way.
Yes, we've just heard from the mayor of the city of Rio de Janeiro just a couple of hours ago that he would reverse the partial lockdown in the city. He didn't give further details, but that happened after Bolsonaro's speech yesterday.
It seems extraordinary that perhaps Brazil is really out on its own with regards to this. Many other countries are putting in place more and more strict lockdowns. But what are people doing to help the shutdowns at a more local level? I hear that there's a lot of activity in the favelas, in the informal shanty towns.
Yes, we've been seeing in communities all over Brazil a huge effort to make people aware. Community leaders are using loudspeakers, putting up signs, trying to convey the message that we need to stay home as much as we can. And the message seems to be getting through, maybe because of the news that we've been getting from Europe, especially from Italy and Spain. Brazilians, which are very social people, they've been seeming to been getting the idea that we need to have social distancing in order to try to flatten the curve of infection here.
Camila Mota in Brazil. Spain has become only the second country after Italy to record more deaths than China. Spanish officials have said 3,400 people have now died there. The country's emergencies coordinator, Fernando Simón, said Spain was approaching a peak in levels of infections.
At the moment, the evolution of new cases being registered over the last few days means that if we are not at the peak, we're very close to the peak. But obviously, the workload facing the health services is likely to grow for a few more days, whether or not we observe a decrease in transmission.
In a video on Twitter, the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, said efforts to address shortages of vital equipment had been successful.
Spain needs masks to protect people, in particular health workers, from the virus. I'm very happy to announce good news. The joint procurement of masks and other protective equipment that the Commission coordinates is successful. We have received offers of masks and gloves exceeding our requests. And in 2 weeks, the masks, gloves, overalls, goggles will be in your hospitals. We have also launched joint public procurement to buy ventilators and testing kits, which are sorely needed too.
Well, the Spanish government has even asked NATO for help in procuring medical aid. I heard more from the journalist Sara Canals, who's in Barcelona.
It's a sign that one of the top priorities right now is precisely to assist hospitals and healthcare centers on the main challenges that they face every day, such as the shortage of equipment and the overload in patients. And this is why the government has officially requested international assistance to the NATO, asking specifically for medical equipment, such as surgical masks, rapid test kits, ventilators, gowns, and gloves. But this is not the only effort that Spain is undertaking to tackle the coronavirus crisis and the fact that the health system is on the brink of collapse. Today, the government has signed a 400 million euro deal with China to acquire medical equipment. This morning, more than 600,000 rapid test kits have arrived from China and South Korea. These tests will be delivered first to healthcare workers and then to nursing homes. And many hotels across the country have offered their spaces and extra beds to treat sick people.
Now, Sara, you're in Barcelona. Madrid has had the most cases so far, but I understand that this virus is spreading quite rapidly across the country.
Exactly. And Spain has seen a much wider territorial spread of COVID cases compared to Italy, for instance. The outbreak started to escalate in Madrid, and now it is everywhere, with regions such as Catalonia, Andalusia, the Basque Country, being hardly hit by the virus. Some believe that this is due to the high mobility across the country before the state of alarm was implemented, and some have criticized Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez for not having reacted faster to the crisis and for not having been more restrictive with the lockdown measures.
Sara Canals in Spain. Here in Britain, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson has defended the government's response to the pandemic in the face of continued criticism that too few frontline health workers are being tested or getting essential protective equipment. Mr Johnson said every possible effort was being made to ensure it was distributed to them. He said testing was vital and would soon be available for several thousand people a day.
He is quite right that testing is vital to our success in beating the coronavirus. And as the Health Secretary has explained many times, we are massively increasing our testing campaign, going up from 5,000 to 10,000 to 25,000 a day.
Well, the National Health Service in England said on Wednesday that a further 28 people who tested positive for COVID-19 have died, bringing the number of confirmed deaths to 414. The lower house of the German parliament has approved a huge rescue package to protect the economy during the pandemic. The programme is being funded by taking on new debt. Damien McGuinness reports from Berlin.
With unprecedented speed and an unusual amount of cross-party unity, Germany's parliament has passed an aid package worth $800 billion. Employees whose jobs are at risk will go part-time, and their new lower wages will be paid by the state. Small firms and self-employed workers will get direct cash grants of up to $16,000. Families will get financial support, and a temporary new law will make it illegal for landlords to evict tenants who can't pay their rent.
Damien McGuinness. President Putin says the referendum on constitutional changes that would allow him to stay in office is going to be postponed because of the pandemic. The Russian leader gave no details about when the vote would take place. Steve Rosenberg is in Moscow.
Among the changes that Vladimir Putin is proposing to the constitution is one amendment that would, if it's supported by the public, allow him to stay in power, potentially, until 2036, but he made it clear that in the current circumstances, because of the pandemic, this wasn't going to be possible at this time. He said that the priority for him was the health and the safety of the Russian people.
Well, the plan has been heavily criticised by the opposition, who say that the president is clinging on to power. Mr Putin also announced a series of measures to combat the coronavirus outbreak, including telling all except key workers to stay at home for a week. Even official statistics now show a steady and sharp rise in the infection rate across Russia. Each day, the coronavirus crisis is creating a torrent of online videos. Some are posted by celebrities keen to have their say, but is what they're saying worth listening to? Our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd lent an ear.
Hit it.
After COVID-19 struck, smart TV celebrities quickly shed studio glamour for vlogging from home.
Hi, everybody. This is episode 2 of The Tonight Show, home edition.
Like US chat show host Jimmy Fallon.
Thank you, Freddie. Thank you. Guys, we had such a great response from our show last night. Thank you so much.
The lesson is we're all in the same boat. Even TV stars find it tough to keep the kids entertained, though we don't all get to chat with Lin-Manuel Miranda online.
Washington Heights!
We are doing the cool thing to do, which is self-quarantining, and so we are learning how to homeschool.
Oh my
I agree
God.
With Shonda Rhimes' tweet, every teacher should make $1 billion a year.
I mean, like, oh my gosh, right? How yeah. hard is this?
Look at this. Celebrity hand washing is suddenly a big thing.
A little bit on it. No, just watch this.
Probably there's a series in it somewhere. Everyone's reminding us, from Stephen Sondheim to Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Everyone should do that. Everyone should wash their hands at least 20 seconds. And do it as many times as possible. I wash my hands a minimum of 50 times a day.
Madonna is giving the world her quarantine diaries, already at episode 4.
Tonight, today, and tomorrow,
I'm going to try to focus on the positive.
Sitting surrounded by candles and tapping out thoughts on an old typewriter.
I managed to get out and get 1 hour of sunshine in the garden.
Apparently unaware, electricity is still fine.
COVID-19 will definitely make me a more tolerant person. What I really miss, and this is truth, is being able to talk in front of an audience.
There's criticism. Madonna's coronavirus diaries are too self-obsessed, but people are watching online.
Look around, everywhere you turn is COVID. It's everywhere that you go.
As they are, singer Chris Mann's new COVID-friendly version of her 30-year-old hit, now retitled Stay Home, Vogue.
Settle into the quarantine, flatten the corona curve.
That was Vincent Dowd reporting. Well, lots of celebrities have also been donating money and offering help. The tennis player Roger Federer is giving $1 million to vulnerable families in his native Switzerland. And the British boxer Amir Khan is offering to turn over a large property he owns to Britain's health service. Also in this podcast,
it has been played on the Space Shuttle, performed at the White House, and is accompanied by one of the best-known dance routines of all time.
Now, which song has been officially listed in the United States as one of the country's most historically important sound recordings of all time? Find out later. Now to India, and 1.3 billion people are under lockdown in an attempt to prevent an explosion of coronavirus cases in the country. The Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, ordered everyone indoors for the next 3 weeks, saying it was the only way to avoid a disaster and effectively shutting down Asia's third largest economy. So how is the population responding? Here's the BBC's Arunoday Mukherjee in Delhi.
The police in New Delhi on Wednesday morning could be heard amplifying the Indian Prime Minister's appeal from the previous night for a complete nationwide lockdown for the next 21 days. Stay home and stay safe, else face not only health but legal consequences, was the message. Bustling cities of India turned into ghost towns overnight, with not one soul to be seen. Only essential services workers were spotted from time to time, helping in keeping the city clean. We came across a family of four who failed to get home before the lockdown.
No one is helping us. People are scared to give us a ride in their cars because of the virus. The police are also asking for our identity cards.
Desperate and worried for their children, they are now having to cycle nearly 15 miles to get home. We could see some others lining up at pharmacies and grocery stores, and we asked them whether the measures were too drastic.
This is good that Prime Minister Modi has enforced a lockdown. It's the only way forward.
People have just queued it up. There's no stock, no vegetable, nothing. Our daily needs are also not getting met.
These are unprecedented scenes in a country of 1.3 billion people, unimaginable before this crisis. Many observers say that only a politician like Narendra Modi could take and implement such a drastic step.
But elsewhere, in the older part of Delhi, hundreds of homeless people gathered to protest against officials, demanding they be given food and shelter. Some here felt hunger would kill them before coronavirus did. The Indian government is still mulling an economic bailout for the most affected sectors, but it's the poor people of India who will be hit hardest. I spoke to an economist who spelt out how fighting coronavirus was important, but also stressed the importance of ensuring the lockdown doesn't bring with it other challenges.
It is very important on part of the government to ensure that the food supply chains continue to be operational, because it's one thing saying that, you know, the shops which sell essential things will be open. But then those shops don't produce those things on their own. I mean, there is a certain supply chain.
While many are praising the Prime Minister for taking drastic steps, medical experts feel a lockdown alone isn't enough. Here's public health expert Dr. Manjunath Shankar.
It won't put out the fire. And even if it put out the fire,
people will be traveling internationally and the disease has spread all over the world. So the fire might just come back again. The government also needs to do other steps like increase surveillance and testing across the country so that we can go and do control measures. We can do isolation, quarantine, treatment.
The Prime Minister pledged $2 billion towards health infrastructure only for fighting coronavirus. Another massive fiscal package is on the cards in the coming days. The effects of coronavirus will be long-lasting, especially for an already fragile Indian economy growing at its slowest in 6 years. With businesses shutting down, millions of jobs will be at stake. The next 3 weeks are crucial for India and will determine the trajectory the virus takes in one of the most densely populated countries of the world.
Arunode Mukherjee in India. The biggest exporter of cut flowers in Europe, Kenya, is beginning to feel the impact of the shutdowns. Operations across flower farms in the country have almost ground to a halt as demand has dipped by over 90%. More than 100,000 workers are at risk of losing their jobs. The BBC's senior Africa correspondent, Anne Soy, reports from central Kenya.
I've come to a flower farm just outside Nairobi and I'm walking now next to the greenhouses. It's quiet today. I can see a few workers who are still here. So this place is usually busier.
Very busy.
An administrator at this farm we aren't allowed to identify shows me around.
And there are some walking tractors that are moving around collecting the flowers. So we've sent almost all the drivers on leave.
We're just walking into one of the greenhouses. I can see there are a few workers here. Habari? There are many rows of white rose flowers here and I'm following one of the employees here. She's cutting the stems. They're not going to sell these. They would have exported them, but it's just not possible anymore. So they're cutting all the flowers that are already in full bloom and putting them together in bunches, and then they just have to be dumped.
All of them. The tractor will move, go around, collecting all of them, and there's a heap we'll show you there.
Okay. The workers load the stems onto the trailer, and the tractor takes them to the dumping site.
Having to dump flowers is a very painful thing for us, even in a day.
Clement Tulezi is the spokesperson of the Flower Council.
We are in the most difficult time of our industry. We have never gone through a period like this. This is completely unprecedented, something we never expected to have happened. We, in terms of foreign exchange, we are among the top four foreign exchange earners for Kenya. And therefore, you know how crucial we are, not just in terms of money, but also in terms of employment and how much we support the economy.
He says already seasonal workers have lost their jobs. And if the pandemic persists, even staff are at risk of losing their livelihoods.
We employ over 150,000 people directly in the farms. And by extension, those who provide other auxiliary services like and goods are up to 500,000. By and large, we support over 4 million livelihoods. So it will be another catastrophe where we'll be dealing with poverty and hunger and people not being able to meet their daily needs.
I've come now to the grading hall and I can see there are metal tables here, a conveyor belt in the middle. This place ordinarily would have been busy, but most of the employees have had to go on leave because there's nothing much to do here. On one end of the hall, I can see lots and lots of bunches of flowers, all manner of colours, red, pink, yellow, white. Some of them had even been packaged, but now they're stuck here. Just outside the grading hall, there is a huge heap of cut flowers. This is the dumping site. The once beautiful blossoms are now wilting, much like Kenya's flower industry.
And soy in Kenya. Now to some other news. Turkish prosecutors have charged 20 Saudi nationals in connection with the murder of the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. From Istanbul, Ola Guerin reports.
Saudi Arabia has blamed the brutal killing of Jamal Khashoggi on a rogue operation, but the indictment from Turkish prosecutors reaches to senior levels in the kingdom. It accuses the former deputy head of Saudi General Intelligence, Ahmed al-Asiri, of instigating the deliberate and monstrous killing. A former aide to the Saudi royal court, Saud al-Qahtani, faces the same charge. 18 other Saudi nationals are accused of carrying out the killing.
Ola Guerin. Afghanistan's National Security Council says representatives of the government and the Taliban are going to meet face-to-face for further discussions on the exchange of prisoners. No date was given for the talks, which, when they happen, will mark a significant moment in relations between the rival sides. Negotiations have so far taken place by video conference. On Wednesday, a date was set of March the 31st for the release of a batch of 100 Taliban prisoners from government-run jails. Now, here's Jackie Leonard with a request.
About a month ago, we put together a special edition of the Global News podcast answering your questions on the coronavirus. Well, as you will be very well aware, the story is continuing to develop and has changed. So if you have any new questions, just send them to us and we will again try to find answers for you. Send a recording of your question telling us who and where you are to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Thank you.
Get your questions to us by Sunday the 29th of March, please. Now, let's go back to the United States, where the government says anyone who has left New York City in the last few days should self-quarantine for the next 2 weeks. Two-thirds of all new confirmed cases across the US have been diagnosed in the city. The governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, has compared the speed of the spread to a bullet train. Here, some New Yorkers have been telling us how they have been dealing with the situation.
I'm urging all of my family members to stay home. My mom's in her 80s and she's under strict instructions. We love her so much. Please stay home. Don't go out. My business is commercial real estate. It's at a standstill. So I ask where I can help. I contributed to getting masks made by my classic sofa, which made my sofa. So people are really extraordinary, and I'm very proud of New Yorkers. We're trying desperately not to get sick.
I think the most challenging thing for me right now is, okay, when is this going to end so that I can get back into my, get back on with my social work and helping others. And here, you know, my husband's home, family are home, we're trying to all be civil with one another.
Well, just before we recorded this podcast, President Trump gave an update on the situation regarding the coronavirus in the U.S.
I have now approved major disaster declarations for New York, California, Washington, Iowa, Louisiana, Texas, and Florida. We've been spending a lot of time with New York officials because that really is by far the hottest spot. They've got a number of very tough weeks ahead of them.
Dr. Craig Spencer is Director of Global Health in Emergency Medicine at Columbia University Hospital in New York. He's got an unusual perspective in that he actually survived the deadly virus Ebola, which he contracted while working as a doctor in West Africa 5 years ago. John Donison asked him first, though, about the current situation with coronavirus at his hospital in New York.
Right now in New York City, the streets seem eerily empty. But as soon as you walk into the hospital, everything is completely transformed. The patients that we're seeing are increasing on a daily basis, and the overwhelming majority of them are coronavirus patients. The people that come to us are incredibly sick. Many of them are requiring a breathing tube and a ventilator. For many, that's really the only hope that we're going to be able to save their lives. Some of my colleagues throughout the city are mentioning that they're intubating or putting a breathing tube in 1 to 2 patients per hour. And you can imagine 1 to 2 patients per hour at every hospital in New York over the span of the next couple of days and next couple of weeks. The need for ventilators, the need for healthcare providers, the needs for personal protective equipment are going to be huge.
How close is your hospital and other hospitals to being at capacity?
Some places are already reaching capacity. This is something that is hitting all of New York City and all of the region extremely hard. That's why the governor has called for utilizing the Javits Convention Center here in Manhattan as a temporary field hospital, where we'll be able to put many of these patients who quite honestly just can't fit in our hospitals, even if they're surging and increasing the number of beds available to patients.
Now, at the end of your piece you've written in the Washington Post, you say you might hear people saying it isn't real. It is. You might hear people saying it isn't bad. It is. Do your part. Stay home. Stay safe. And I will come to work for you. Has that message got across now? Are people staying home in New York?
People are staying home in New York, but I think what we're hearing is mixed messages from local authorities or state authorities and then the federal government. The idea that we're going to be somehow on the other side of this in just a few weeks by Easter.
You've had President Trump saying he thinks things could be up and running again under 3 weeks by Easter. At the same time, you've got your governor, Governor Cuomo, saying the virus is spreading faster than a bullet train.
We're just at the beginning of this. I mean, the case counts are doubling almost every day. And the idea that we'll have packed churches on Easter Sunday gives me so much heartache and so much pause and so much concern. It was just over 3 weeks ago that the first coronavirus case was identified in New York City. The idea that in 3 weeks' time, we're going to be anywhere close to past this is unspeakable. There's absolutely no way. It sends the wrong message. It's dangerous. We need to be telling people what they can do to protect themselves, and that is staying at home. The virus cannot infect you if it cannot find you.
Now, 5 years ago, you survived Ebola, having caught that treating patients in West Africa. I mean, how has that affected your perspective on what's happening now?
It's a great question. It's impacted my perspective because right now I understand what all of my colleagues here in New York and in other places fighting this virus are feeling. That mental anxiety and that mental stress of taking care of patients, that thought that a microscopic virus can infect you at every encounter. In addition to the physically exhausting part of doing this work, the mentally exhausting part is huge. So the one thing I want to tell all of my healthcare colleagues is, you're not alone. We all feel the same way, even if we're not sharing it. Be vulnerable. Talk to your friends. Talk to your colleagues. And we're going to get through this.
I mean, that must have been an incredibly scary time for you and your family.
Yeah, the difference is really drastic, right? Coronavirus and Ebola are both viruses, but in some ways, they're completely different. Coronavirus is, for lack of a better word, perfect. It doesn't kill that many, but it infects so many. It transmits before we have symptoms. Like, everything about it makes it the perfect vector, the perfect virus to be causing this pandemic. Ebola virus, of course, was quite different. In many ways, it was a disease of pure compassion. People that were infected were those that were taking care of sick patients. The one difference for providers is that in West Africa, we never had to worry about our personal protective equipment. We had a seemingly endless supply. And right now, what you're hearing in New York City and in many other places is that our personal protective equipment supply is strained.
That was Dr. Craig Spencer, Director of Global Health in Emergency Medicine at Columbia University Hospital in New York. Now, we're going to end on a very different note. It's been the soundtrack which has inspired millions of people to wave their arms in the air at weddings and birthday parties around the world. Now, YMCA by the Village People has been officially listed in the United States as one of the country's most historically important sound recordings of all time. The US Library of Congress has added the 1978 disco anthem to its National Recording Registry, where it sits alongside Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You and Martin Luther King's speech, I Have a Dream. Here's our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson.
It has been played on the Space Shuttle, performed at the White House, and is accompanied by one of the best-known dance routines of all time. Now, YMCA has been added to a list of the most historically important sound recordings curated by the US Library of Congress. They say the song has been included as it is an American cultural phenomenon. YMCA now joins the likes of President Woodrow Wilson's Armistice Broadcast from 1923. And Neil Armstrong speaking on the moon.
That's one small step for man.
Victor Willis, the Village People's lead singer who dressed as the policeman and wrote the lyrics, has expressed his delight, saying that he's glad the group's music has made people smile for more than 40 years.
That report by Colin Patterson, and yes, you've guessed it, we could only finish with this again. We'll be right back. And that is all from us for now. But there's going to be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, thanks for listening and goodbye.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Banking with Capital One means five times the savings toward your dream honeymoon, or five times the savings toward your family's ultimate vacation, even five times the savings toward just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member FDIC.